Welcome back to the Intellectual Explorers podcast. Today, Aaron Lewis is on the podcast. Aaron is a writer and former digital product designer for Uber and for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. Now, according to his website, his focus is on memetic warfare, preventing online radicalization, and cultivating compassionate communities in IRL and URL. Aaron and I have been trading tweets for a while now, and I asked him to come on the podcast after I read his awesome article, You Can Handle the Post-Truth, A Pocket Guide to the Surreal Internet. I think Aaron is one of the writers to keep an eye out on in whatever you want to call this space, the post-para-meta-rational sense-making the memetic warfare space. In this exploration, we discussed sense-making as a part-time job, computer-generated virtual influencers, data voids, dying online and digital ghosts, coming out of the closet as a form of graypilling, and being hope-punked. If you have any questions or comments about this episode of the podcast in general, you can find me on Twitter at Peter N. Lindberg. All right, enjoy this exploration I had with Aaron. Today, I'm exploring with Aaron Lewis. Before we begin, I'm going to anchor myself in an exploratory mindset. My intention is to engage in this dialogue with a spirit of exploration. I'm not here to agree or disagree, but to be a performative agnostic and understand my interlocutor's map of reality and possibly explore new territory together. That being said, Aaron, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I love that intro.
So you wrote this awesome article called You Can Handle the Post-Truth, A Pocket Guide to the Surreal Internet. Yep. To clarify, is that you can handle or you can't handle?
You can.
You can.
I was at this conference and they had a panel called You Can't Handle the Post-Truth. I don't want to invert it because I think that people are able to really handle it if they can better understand
that. Yeah. And one thing I appreciate about you is your... at least the feel I get from your writing is there's a level of optimism there.
Yeah, it's sort of it's that balancing act between understanding the severity of what's going on and then also realizing that chaos creates opportunity.
Right. So on your website bio, you have that you're researching and writing about memetic warfare, preventing online radicalization, and cultivating compassionate communities. So I'm curious, why are these subjects captivating you?
Yeah, so for me, the topic of culture war has been really, really personal and sort of something I've had to encounter throughout my entire life because of the way I was raised and the circumstances that I grew up in. Mm-hmm. My dad is Black and my mom is white. My mom is Jewish. My dad is Christian. I grew up in a very conservative religious household. And then I eventually came out as gay. So I've had to kind of like straddle all these different divides over the course of my own personal life. I went to like a very evangelical Christian school from kindergarten through eighth grade. And then in high school, I was just like thrown in this massive pool with like a lot of really liberal atheist people. So my whole life I've kind of been navigating and straddling all these different divides just within my own self, my own family, and my own relationships. So a lot of my interest in sort of what's going on in culture comes from my own personal experience, like dealing with those conflicts in my own life. And then when I read your post, your white paper back in September, I feel like it was a really awesome articulation of sort of what's going on at the macro level. And it helped me kind of connect my own personal narrative with the macro meta story that's happening in like all of culture right now. So that's kind of what made me start really leaning into this stuff.
Interesting. So it's like you had a personal feeling of all these kind of identities pulling you. Like you mentioned, you had a father from a Christian background, mother Jewish, coming out as gay. So it's like you had all these kind of identities pulling you, and then you felt the tension there.
Like, I feel like throughout the course of my life, I've moved through so many different identities. And like when I was younger, the first time I ever encountered racial identity was when kids would find out that my dad is black, my mom is white, and they would ask me like, "So, do you feel more black or more white?" They would want me to sort of like make a decision, right, in a very like literal black or white way. So I really had to kind of learn how to hold that tension and zoom out from just like choosing one or the other, and start to think of myself as like the container that all those different things move through. Or my friend Visa on Twitter, he has a great metaphor, which is like, yourself is a band with an ever-changing roster of members that can play whatever music it likes. So that really resonated with me just based on my own experience moving through all these different like identities and belief systems and trying to figure out what is the thing that stays the same, like underneath so much change.
And you mentioned you were with a bunch of atheists at one point. Did you have sort of, this has definitely happened to me, just kind of experiencing all these different reality tunnels and trying to earnestly adopt some. Like, I went through an anarchist phase when I was younger, and then, you know, I went through my atheist phase. Yeah. Did you have something like that?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I think, I mean, after I started really, really, really embedded in evangelical Christianity, because as I said, that's how I grew up. And then I think after that, I sort of reacted against it in a very reactionary way. I got really sucked into sort of like Sam Harris's world and Less Wrong and like the rationalist communities online. And so I think at various phases, I've been really, really like adamant true believer in like lots of different things. And it's honestly similar with sexuality too, because by default, you're like assumed to be straight. And so you kind of like take that as a solid given. And then the experience of coming out of the closet is similar to like leaving any sort of belief system, where you start to realize like, wait, maybe things aren't exactly how I thought they were. And then it becomes an impetus for questioning a lot of different things, because you realize that if this one thing that you assumed was like given really solid is not the case, then what else am I missing out there, you know?
Mm-hmm. So it opens up like possibilities in a way.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a scary process, but it's also a really exciting one, because like you said, it does open up that possibility space when you realize how many things you haven't been questioning up to this point.
Right. And so returning back to your article, you can handle the post-truth. Yeah. In the beginning, I like this line, making sense of 2019 feels like a part-time job. And I'm just about to tap out of this part-time job, because, you know, it is a lot of work. So yeah, can you maybe elaborate on that a little bit more? Why do you think it's a part-time job?
Yeah, so I think one thing I was really noticing is just the gap between like my parents' understanding of the world and my own.
Right.
Sitting at the dinner table and we're talking about like memes and influencers, and those aren't even terms that like make sense to my parents. So the gap is really wide. Things are changing really, really quickly. And what's weird is that the tools that I feel like I was given to basically understand or make sense of the world in college are sort of outdated, and they come from a time when the logic of things was different, right? And there's kind of this weird gap between when your history textbooks end and when you start personally paying attention to what's going on in the world. So part of that sentiment of like feeling like this is a part-time job was like, wait, I feel like a lot of things has changed since the history textbooks that I learned from were written. So I need to kind of actually start telling a story or continuing the thread of the story for myself, like all the way through to the present.
Right. And I want to kind of double click on the whole, that gap. Because I experienced the same thing. Because like yourself, you know, I work at a normal job. That's how I make my livelihood. And, you know, I sent some of my colleagues the white paper to check out. And they're just like, what the heck is this? You know, it's like, what is, like, these things actually exist, these tribes, right? And they didn't, like, they couldn't map, like, not only the mental models that they don't use, right? But they couldn't even map, like, what was actually happening. Nor did they really care. So, do you have, how do you navigate that space? Like, I'm imagining that you operate in some kind of social communities that just don't care about this stuff or don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it's sort of about understanding your audience and like what is their context that they're coming to the conversation with and their interest level. Obviously, your white paper is like a very, very nuanced deep dive on all this stuff. But I think there's a way of translating that level of nuance to various like Zoom levels or levels of complexity, depending on how much the person cares. So to me, the most basic way of talking about it to people who seem like they don't care at all is just like our basic way of understanding politics, or the way we traditionally understand politics, is that there's this blue versus red or left versus right divide. And the internet has sort of like messed up that whole spectrum up where it's not so simple anymore. It's not just left versus right. There's actually all these other groups that are creating their own different types of reality on the internet. So they're sort of messing with our traditional understanding of the political spectrum. And then if they're interested in that, I'll go deeper. But if not, just leave it at that.
Yeah. I'm going to steal that pitch. My sense is that you resonate with the kind of the post-rationalist tribe. Is that true?
I guess this is, I feel like a lot of people on Twitter lately have been talking about this word post-rationalist and whether it's like a good label or a label that makes any sense. I think it's, the funny thing to me is that Venkatesh Rao, who a lot of people associate or say is like the creator of post-rationalist, he disavows the word altogether.
Okay.
So I don't know where I stand on that.
What about the whole kind of the Ribbon Farm community, I guess? Is that sort of...
Yeah, I just got back from the Ribbon Farm conference last weekend, actually. Mm-hmm. And I really like the ethos of it because to me, it's really about making connections with people who give you permission to speculate wildly. And
yeah.
Sort of... understand 2019 in sort of a deep historical context and playing with like really, really big narratives and trying to understand like what's going on right now, sort of the way we're talking about, through like a really, really deep history. And so the whole ethos of the site and the way of like making familiar things strange again is really, really fun and useful, I think.
Yeah, I like the freedom to speculate. That's what I appreciate most about the, you know, if we don't want to call it post-rationalist, the kind of the Venkatesh community. because it's like, you know, like you don't have to be tethered to this version of the truth where you have to get things right or accurate. You can kind of like where your daemon leads you ideationally. It's like, you know, like let's explore that. Let's tap on that. And that's basically, you know, I think most of my tweets are like that. I don't want to be too attached to them. I just want to play.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about the concept of devil's advocate and how it's really a mainstream shorthand for distancing yourself from what you're about to say. And if it's effective, then it basically turns the conversation from a debate into an investigation. So it would be kind of cool. I'm trying to think of how to come up with more fun shorthands that let people switch really easily between different styles or modes of conversation the way Devil's Advocate does when it's done well. And I just play tested this game that Venkatesh Rao designed. It's kind of a, it's like a role-playing card game. And he created six different archetypes that you practice embodying. It's like LARPing different worldviews or different ways of being. So you have to sort of practice kind of like an improv game, getting really good at pretending to be each archetype, embodying each worldview. So you sort of get used to that feeling of switching between different modes and being a little bit more fluid, which is cool.
That is cool. And what kind of archetypes does he use?
So he has six. It's the Holy Warrior, the Investigator, the Operator, the Legalist, the Contrarian, and I think I'm blanking on the last one. Maybe it'll come back to me later.
It'd be cool kind of doing that with active mimetic tribes, you know, like have like a card and then you gotta, I don't know how the game is structured, but kind of like method act that reality tunnel for the duration of the turn or game.
Yeah, he basically gave us sort of a problem space or an issue to discuss as a group, and each person was assigned an archetype and you had to like talk about the problem or the issue from the perspective of that role.
Yeah.
So I think something similar could work for trying to better understand the tribes too.
So I want to kind of dive into the content in the paper, but in the beginning you mentioned you went to a few conferences that I never heard about before, and I was looking at the websites, looked pretty cool. Theorizing the Web and Radical Exchange.
Yeah.
So you just go to all these cool conferences when you're not working, I imagine.
Yeah. So I was working at Uber until about 3 months ago, and I've been on a break since then. So I've had the opportunity to go to some really cool spaces like that.
Nice.
Yeah.
And so what were those conferences about?
So Radical Exchange is a group that spun up in the last year or so. And they're basically trying to challenge this sort of capitalism versus socialism debate dichotomy and come up with creative market-based solutions or improvements to social institutions that don't necessarily like fall into either side of that really polarized divide. And it was a cool conference because they were able to bring together really eclectic mix of people. They had like political activists, they had filmmakers like Boots Riley, they had like really wonky economists, they had poets. Like this woman gave a slam poetry performance, this woman from Detroit gave a slam poetry performance right after Vitalik, the guy who created Ethereum, spoke. So just like a really cool amalgamation of different types of people. And then the second conference, Theorizing the Web, that was created about 11 years ago at a time when more traditional sociology academics and anthropologists weren't really interfacing as much with tech and the tech community, thinking about what internet is doing to culture. So this group, Theorizing Web, tried to really bring these two camps together. Because a lot of times tech is very allergic to theory. It's not very excited about like thinking about stuff in the abstract. It's more about like executing and just shipping really fast and breaking things, et cetera. So this was kind of a venue where leading edge people in academia would meet up with or collaborate with leading edge people in tech and try to kind of figure out what the hell is going on and what the internet is doing to culture.
Right. So, and I think those two conferences that you went to, amongst other things, kind of influenced writing this paper.
Yeah, definitely.
And so you had kind of, it was really good visuals on it, and you had four kind of sections. Souls of Virtual Folk, Roll Your Own Reality, Digital Rebirth and the Death of Consensus, and The Only Way Out is Through. And I always appreciate like well-worded titles and coinages. So hats off to you. So maybe we can just go briefly through each and kind of like talk about the premises there.
Sounds good.
And so the kind of the souls of the virtual folk, like how would you describe the premise?
So this section was sort of about the rise of what's called virtual influencers. So basically a couple of marketing agencies have created these computer generated influencers that look quite real. They have like in some cases over a million followers on Instagram. So what I was exploring here is kind of how do these Instagram influencers who are computer generated sort of challenge what we think of as authentic? How do they relate to like politicians' accounts who oftentimes or sometimes feel more fake than the Instagram influencers' accounts, oddly? And then also, how are these Instagram influencer accounts, how do they represent a sort of corporate co-opting of their critics' language? So for example, Lil Miquela is this fake biracial woman, and she talks a lot on her Instagram account about how she's like woke and how she's just being used by corporate interests to like sell capitalist products. But obviously she is a creation of marketing agency that is doing that. So it's this sort of weird, this weird thing where she's like self-aware yet also like selling product at the same time. So I use the virtual influencers as an entry point to what's happening in a lot of different places, around the world and on the internet, of how basically corporate, interests can sometimes hijack the language of their critics in order to advance their interests. So the example I gave was a truck driver strike in Brazil that was organized on WhatsApp. And what happened was all the protests and political organizing was happening through these WhatsApp groups, and a lot of far-right business leaders were able to infiltrate these groups and spread their message like throughout all these different WhatsApp groups. And it was, they basically like took over the message, the narrative from the inside, almost like a virus. And they were able to co-opt the language of their critics in order to sort of neuter the movement.
Mm-hmm. I think a few things came to mind. There's this whole idea of hyper reality. Mm-hmm. Where we can't even tell like what is real anymore. Because if we have these, like you said something like soon we might have a CGI candidate for office.
Or, it's actually the plot of a Black Mirror episode.
Oh shit, like, I'm not surprised. And and the whole deepfakes thing, like soon, like, you know, if the technology gets to the point where we can't even tell, or no detection tools can kind of tell a deepfake from a real video, then who knows what's gonna manifest in the internet?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting about this is like there's a lot of moral panic around it, but I wonder. So the assumption underlying all the moral panic is that images and videos are like the ultimate arbiter of reality, right? But if you kind of zoom out and look at the historical context, the idea that a video or an image is the ultimate arbiter of reality is like an extremely recent invention, because society managed to cohere somehow before the invention of photography, right? So it might turn out that this was actually sort of just like a brief blip in history where we take images and videos as like the ultimate sign of truth, and that our orientation or paradigm towards them is going to just like shift in a way that we can't really predict right now, because we're so caught up in that way of thinking about reality and what's real. And what's the other thing that I think is important to note is that in the beginning in the 20th century, like with the radio and the television, all of our attention systems were basically hijacked and shifted from local community level to the national level. Like mass media basically enabled this attentional shift from what's immediate, what's around you, to a sort of soap opera that's going on at the national level. And it doesn't seem to me necessarily that that's actually been like a net positive for society. So there's a way of thinking about this, which is to say that lack of trust in media because of deepfakes might actually be undoing a lot of harm that has been done through the shift from the local level to national dramas that we have no control over and are sort of just like manufactured reality TV.
Mm-hmm. This is where your optimism is kicking in again.
Yeah.
So it's like the idea there could be a wholesale distrust amongst images in general, because if you can't tell what's real, what's fake, then you're going to return to other means of sense making, like in-person communication.
Yeah, and I think, other means of sense making and ways of making sense of your identity that aren't necessarily really wrapped up in national politics, and more wrapped up in the relationships and communities that you care about personally. Because a lot of the driving force behind this polarization is the fact that people's identities right now are really, really wrapped up in national parties, which is more exaggerated now than it was in the past.
Right. And in this section as well, you mentioned the Russia's Internet Research Agency, mm-hmm. and how they're engaged with I like how James Scott words it, the chaos operations. Yes. Just kind of stirring memetic shit for its own sake.
It's like the Joker, basically.
Right, right. And yeah, can you speak on that a little bit, like what they're up to?
Yeah, so Renee D'Aresta, who's a researcher at Mozilla, she's done a lot of really awesome work on this, which is where I'm drawing from. But she basically, she writes about the Internet Research Agency, which is a Russian intelligence operation. It's basically like they hire a lot of people to do these white collar jobs, which is to study really intensely various subcultures on the internet, and then try to understand them well enough that they can then imitate them and create social media groups and echo chambers that attracts the type of people that they are targeting. So what they got good at leading up to the 2016 election was imitating these groups and sort of stoking in-group identity for the purpose of like spreading their messaging. And what was kind of shocking to me is the way in which they actually formed personal relationships with well-intentioned internet activists who didn't even know that they were interfacing with these operatives. So they would not only create like meme groups and meme pages on Instagram or Tumblr or Facebook or whatever, but also like form personal relationships with the people who ran similar groups in order to further their chaotic goals.
Hmm. Devious.
Yes.
Did you watch that documentary called Hypernormalization?
Is that Adam Curtis?
Yes.
I think I've watched some of it.
Yeah.
All of it though.
That's really good. It's really good because he talks about how I forget the guy's name, but he's sort of the propaganda media person. Oh, in Bernays. Say that again.
Edward Bernays.
No. He's still alive. He's like a Russian government official, but he's from the theater world, and he does this tactic, right, where you just puts people.
Yeah, I have this together. Book on the desk next to me. It's called Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. And it's all about how postmodern theater basically informs Russian political strategy.
Yeah, that's it. That's about that guy. So anybody listening right now, I really recommend Hypernormalization. This is a pretty solid. Same guy who wrote Century of Self when they talked about Edward Bernays. Mm-hmm. So the next section you have, Roll Your Own Reality. And you have like four kind of recommendations, but you mentioned something called data voids. I never heard that before. Can you speak about what that is?
Yeah, so data voids is a technique or a method by which some internet extremist groups try to sort of pull people into their rabbit holes. So basically they understand that SEO, like search engine optimization, can be a really powerful tool. So what they'll do is they'll sort of seed really niche or specific terms that don't have a lot of content associated with them in their manifestos or their writings, and try to get people to search for these very specific terms, because they know that when people search for those terms, the only content that comes up will be the content that they're trying to push people towards. So the results page is filled with results that only come from one point of view, because there's a void of of, there's a void of other people talking about those particular terms. So it's a tactic that Dana Boyd talks a lot about in some of the research she's been doing recently as like a new tool that people are using to try to draw people in.
Interesting. And you had kind of these four strategies. Maybe you can remind me what the strategies were for. I have them written down. What they're in a response to, I should say. It's go local, go authoritarian, go virtual, and go meta.
Yes. So the role your own reality section is really about how the internet combined with distrust in traditional political institution combined with economic anxiety has produced like a new wave of conspiracy theorizing. And there's now a lot of this happening on the web. So, and what I really try to emphasize here is that there's kind of a caricature of right-wing conspiracy theorists on the left, which is that they're somehow like anti-science or they're not rational. And I think what's really important to understand, like if you go and watch Alex Jones, which I don't necessarily recommend, but if you were to watch him, you'd see that these conspiracy theorists think of themselves as heirs of the Enlightenment. Like they're basically, they're doing their own research. They say that they're thinking for themselves. They say that they're trying to draw their own conclusions based on their own data and experimentation. So it's not so much that they think that they perceive themselves as somehow anti-science or anti-rational. They also claim to be the heirs of that Enlightenment rationality tradition. So I think that's an important thing to just recognize in order to not like create a straw man out of them. So what I was getting at with those four approaches is now that we have all these different versions of reality that are popping up, basically all these different conspiracy theorists and political actors who are trying to suck people into various information bubbles, how should we think about moving through this problem? So the four approaches that I laid out was going local, going meta, going authoritarian, and going virtual. So going local is sort of what I was alluding to earlier, which is like a return to basing identities based on communities and sort of local relationships. And what I think is interesting about this is I don't necessarily mean it in like a localism, let's go back to hunting and gathering sense, but I think there's also a sort of like digital localism that 21st century media enables, in that you're able to like find and connect with people who share your interests and passions, even if you're not geographically local to them. So it's really, really hard to be a conspiracy theorist, or it's harder to be a conspiracy theorist about things that are happening like in your local community, because usually conspiracy theorizing is a side effect of like huge power imbalances where you feel helpless in the face of like a really big complex system. But if you actually feel like you have the power to change things or have some kind of effect, instead of just conspiracy theorizing, you actually like, go out and do that work. So that's the go local piece. The go virtual piece, this is sort of an acknowledgement that for a lot of people would just prefer to exist in a reality that is simpler, is more constrained, there's more certainty, it's more well-defined. So for a lot of people, this ends up being video games. So they would basically like rather participate in the Fortnite economy, say, than the economy out here in the real world. So that's kind of a move to virtual. And what I just, as I was writing this piece, I discovered the new Oculus marketing campaign, and their tagline is "Define your own reality." Nice. So they're definitely leaning into that stance. The go authoritarian. This is basically the philosophy that in order to make society cohere, you have to limit information flows and protect people from information outside of the bubble that you want them to be in. So a lot of authoritarian governments are taking this approach and trying to just shut down the open internet in order to create a single coherent reality bubble. And then the last, Go Meta, this is a lot of what you talk about. And the idea here is a sort of humble curiosity or fluidity between lots of different stances, and trying to understand what are the meta narratives that that are playing out. And I, the example I give in the article, which I think is really, really awesome and interesting, is this publication called Epsilon Theory. And what they're doing is they're analyzing political journalism and political reporting at the meta level. So they're basically doing a quantitative analysis of all the different stories that are being produced about the election. And then they're giving you, they're reporting on almost like the behavior of the journalism industry as a whole, like the journalism industry as if it's an organism unto itself. And by doing that, they can sort of tell you how various narratives are shaping up. They can tell you like how cautious you should be when reading about certain topics, because if a lot of different outlets are sort of independently using the same rhetoric or turns of phrase, then you know that there is some groupthink happening, or not a lot of like independent free thinking. So it's a really interesting approach to like thinking about a problem, because instead of just dialing in on one channel or being really zoomed in on your particular like publication that you like, it's trying to like look at the entire landscape and get a sense of what that thing is doing. Mm-hmm.
And the next section, digital rebirth and the death of consensus. I thought it was interesting how you put these two together. But yeah, could you speak on both of those and why you decided them to lump them in this section?
Yeah, so this section was inspired by Timothy Recuber's work. So he's doing a lot of work about digital death. And he outlines three really interesting ways that people think about dying online. One is just like memorial metaphor, where your Facebook page turns into a memorial that people can write on and write nice things about you, things like that. That's not new. That's more just like a digital translation of something that already exists. Then there's the heirloom or the artifact metaphor, which is where you're like leaving behind a bunch of stuff that other people can hold on to in order to remember you. So maybe like a lot of writing or media or blog posts or whatever that will continue on after you pass away. And then the third one is this idea of like reincarnation, which is where it gets really trippy, which is like basically people thinking of their digital selves as almost like a soul that continues to live on after their physical bodies pass away. And this is becoming more and more realizable as a thing, because companies like Facebook are creating really, really high fidelity virtual avatars of people. And there's also other organizations that are working on basically training AI chatbots on your entire communication history. So if I give it all my emails, all my text messages, everything I've ever written, I can interact with this bot sort of as if it's me. So the idea here, which is kind of like a wild speculation of mine, is like if you have these two things, you have like a VR avatar of a person, and also you kind of know how they communicate, what you're basically doing is making someone's digital self like quasi-immortal. You're basically like allowing someone to continue communicating with you. And in a certain sense, like this sounds really, really new when you first think about it. But then I was also thinking back to sort of like history of religion and how religion developed. And there's a sense in which all different types of media have been a way of trying to like transcend death. So any sort of prophet or religious leader or person who wants their ideas to keep on existing, they'll write them down or encode it in some sort of like pictures or writing or something. So in a sense, like these VR avatars that we're now creating are a descendant in this like really long tradition of trying to keep ourselves and our ideas alive after we pass away. Mm. So the reason why this is paired with the death of consensus bit is that traditionally the realm or traditionally the institutions that would do this kind of thing, like institutions that had a sort of monopoly on immortality, were always religious institutions. And religious institutions were often the drivers of new media, like the Catholic Church creating architecture, creating, like, funding really awesome painters, funding stained glass, all for the purpose of, like, communicating their ideas. So, but now what you have is, like, a growing basically competition with religious traditions for these types of, like, immortal media. So all these different influencers or people who are trying to create reality bubbles are almost competing with traditional religions to suck people into their various, like, versions of reality. And that's where the idea of the death of consensus comes in, which is that in the past, religions were really, really good at creating society-wide consensus, and they made it so that everyone was sort of on the same page. But now that they have all this competition that's enabled by new media, you have a death of the type of consensus that used to exist before.
Right, right. And I think we called that the reality crisis in our paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one thing came to mind is, like, digital ghosts.
Yes. Know,
if you have, imagine some kind of algorithm gets unleashed, and then they're creating Twitter accounts, Facebook accounts, still trying to keep itself alive.
Right.
Man. Yeah, there's a lot of rich threads of speculation, the futurism. So just kind of just think about what the heck's in store, and are we prepared for it?
Yeah, and I think something that I'm really curious about is like how will this new media continue to fuse with really deep religious traditions? Because it seems sort of implausible to me that they're gonna just, like, go away. I'm curious about how that mashup is going to play out too, because they've always been involved in the creation and maintenance of new media, and I don't think this time will be any different.
Right. So the last section you had is the only way out is through.
Yeah.
Can you remind me what this section was about?
Yeah. So this section was about how do we think about moving forward? And I think a lot of times the phrase we use is, like, is there any way out of this? Or, like, no way out, right?
Right, right.
And what I'm trying to emphasize is, like, I think I would call myself maybe, like, an irreversibilist, which is, like, you can't really go backwards. So the metaphor of, like, a way out is actually misguided, because this is happening, it's going to continue happening. So we have to, like, really sort of lean into it and try to like move through it, as opposed to trying to, like, escape from it. So what I wrote about here was kind of the idea of the meta stance, and this is like a fancy term, sort of, but what it really means is, like, understanding that history is the story of the stories that we've told about ourselves. And that now that there's, like, all these different competing versions of reality, what we have to do is sort of, or what I think we should do is sort of hold them, learn how to hold them in tension, and understand that no one version is going to be, like, completely right or completely true, and that's okay. That we can sort of, like, Venkatesh's card game outlines, we can sort of practice switching between all these different modes, and the process of switching between different styles and worldviews and ways of understanding can itself be a sort of game that we're all playing. Timothy Morton has this idea of playful seriousness, which I really like, which is this notion that you kind of are smiling because you know that no solution or way of thinking will be totally correct, but you're always willing to keep on evolving.
It's sort of like the infinite player in James Carse's ideas.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of what gets lost when we talk about meta is, I think people think that meta just means an outside view or some kind of detachment. And I think if we understand meta in that way, then it would be almost like a regression to sort of Kant style subject object thinking. I think what I'm sort of talking about in this part of the essay is thinking of meta more as like a strange loop or a Mobius strip. And the best metaphor that I've come across for this is the idea that you are not stuck. You're not stuck in traffic, you are traffic. So there's this weird thing that happens where when you try to view a system from the outside, such as traffic, you also understand like the way that you are still embedded in it and the role that you're playing in the system and the way that it's embedded in you. So there's kind of a weird like loopiness, feedback loop between the outside view and the inside view, where you're recognizing that you can see this traffic system from the outside, but also you are one car in the traffic that's like creating it.
Yeah, I like that. There's this paper I came across as I think the person was a neuro-linguistic programmer, you know, the NLP guys. Yeah. And they talked about the opposite of meta is mesa. And I haven't read the paper, so I'm just guessing what it meant. I read a little bit about it. So this is my speculative guess. Because, you know, your meta is viewing from above or outside. And then mesa is kind of like viewing the term or the concept from within.
Yeah.
And it's like keep going. It's like inception. Just keep going in further, further, further into the concept, breaking it down, going deeper until the point where it's like you reach that propositional bridge to reality in a way.
Yeah.
Right. So you're there, you're in it, you're embedded in it.
Right.
And I think like, say that again.
Well, I've been thinking through ways to make this like a little more personal because it sounds super abstract, right?
Yeah.
And I was thinking about maybe ancestry.com as like a really tangible example of this, where you have like a meta narrative about the history of, say, the United States, like how it developed. And this is like a sort of macro outside view. And then if you pair that with an inside internal view and do some research about your own self and family history on Ancestry, you can kind of like complete the loop, so to speak, or you see how the macro quote unquote outside view is connected / embedded in your own personal history. So like I did this with just learning about a little bit about my family. And I found out that like my great, 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 great grandfather, 5 great grandfathers was in the US colored troops in the Civil War. So all of a sudden I have this like history of the Civil War that I am completely a product of, like I'm only here because of that. And then I also understand sort of the outside more historical view of like how that history unfolded and connecting those things together and creating that feedback loop really makes the abstract meta narrative like come alive because you realize that you are necessarily a part of it.
Right. Right. And I do think that, it's like meta or the capacity to go meta, even pan meta, where you can kind of like be meta about other ideas that you're not operating in, is sort of like a rite of passage for that sort of thing.
Yeah, for sure. And I think of it, I mean, just because of my own personal experience, I think of it as a sort of like coming out of the closet. guys, I think there's a misconception that coming out of the closet is entirely about sexuality when really, it's about what we're talking about, this sort of realization that what you thought was the one way of seeing things actually is not as true as you once believed. So you start to like navigate the uncertainty and sort of understand what that uncertainty feels like.
So that's interesting because like, so for you coming out of the closet is like getting gray-pilled in a way.
It's exactly the same feeling.
Like I'd imagine for some it might be being red pill though, right? Because it's like finally yes, you know, like I am who I am type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it totally. Every person has a different experience, but for my own, it was definitely destabilizing in a way that I was like, whoa, what is going on here? I thought things were one way, and they're actually another way.
Very interesting. So there's a few closing questions I have for you. The this idea of kind of the four strategies, go local. Like for myself, sort of being this informal culture war analyst and just keeping track of all this stuff. And I'm still keeping track of it. And, you know, I have a few articles that are waiting to be published. And, you know, I'm thinking about doing a follow-up white paper on it. But there's like, there's a part of me that just wants to go local. You know, I just want to, yeah. I want to plug out of this stuff.
Yeah, that's what you said on Twitter.
Yeah. I just want to like, you know, I want to stop. Okay. But then the other part of me just wants to keep going. You know what I mean? Like, cause you know, it feels like I'm in too deep. I need to see where this ends. I'm curious if you have that tension, like you just want to like, okay, I have enough, I want to tap out, or you want to keep going.
Yeah, I think it's really important to feed both sides of that tension. Like you need to dance, you need to like connect with the people who you care about, people who matter to you, because that's like, at the end of the day, that's where the work is. Like, I love this mantra, dig where you stand, which is like, like there's a, in some parts of your work, your life, your creative energy has to be directed to the people that you're surrounded by in the community that you're already embedded in. But then it's also important to like, I mean, the type of work you're doing is really valuable because you're helping people see the bigger picture. But it's again about that feedback loop or Mobius strip where you're like looping around the inside view to the outside view. And I think a lot of what will have to happen is like you have to, like you say, create these like fun spaces and places where you can dance and like do a lot of that creative energy, because people need something to like move into, right? But then also there's going to be a lot of there's still going to be a lot of like pain and damage that is done from the culture wars. And something my boyfriend and I have been riffing on based on your concept of mimetic mediators, this concept of what would it look like to have medics on the battlefield of the culture wars. So we combined like the word meme with the word medic, and we came up with this idea of mimetic, and like what would a mimetic do as they're sort of when they're trying to do the healing mode as opposed to the dancing fun mode.
Interesting. It's like came to mind the medic first aid. You know, what does that
mean? Yeah, exactly. Like? That's sort of the metaphor we're playing with.
Yeah, very cool. And like reading, it's interesting just to speak personally, like when I kind of like when I get like plugged back in is when I read like something like your article, right? Because there's like a hopefulness to it. There's, it's like kind of exciting. Like you're at the edge of something, and there is something scintillating about being at the edge of something. Right. And I feel like guys like you and me and all the other weirdos in this space, we feel like we're kind of at the edge of this, trying to make sense of it. So I get kind of inspired with that.
I think for me, it's sort of inspiring to remember that this is not the first time, right? We've been through a lot of these like crazy, weird upturnings in the way we make sense of things. And we have figured it out before. So let's try our best to do it again.
Yeah. On that, I wanted to talk about your optimism. There was this kind of meme that went around. Vox did an article on it. And I thought, well, is this going to be a mimetic tribe that I can write about or research? And it was Hope Punk. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yeah. I have seen it.
And everyone just made fun of it on Twitter. Right? It's like on every single mimetic tribe you could think of, they just like bashed it.
And
I kind of secretly liked it, like this Hope Punk thing. Maybe that, I get the title, like, you know, everyone is sort of like meta is overused, like the word punk is overused. They're just taking it to everything. But the idea of like the Stockdale paradox that I talk about frequently, the Stoicism, like having this kind of radical existential hope that things are going to be okay. But at the same time, like being clear-headed and clear-eyed on what is actually happening, regardless of how crazy it gets. And then holding those two tensions together, right? And I would say that's what the Hope Punk, at least meme, was trying to get at. How do you embody that?
Yeah, I don't think that blind optimism is ever a good thing. So I definitely don't. I definitely don't think that the optimism that you embody is, it should be blind or not paying attention. But I really liked this idea from this book being ecological, which he calls playful care. He says, he makes a distinction between plastic care and playful care. Mm. He says plastic care, stripped down and efficient, is highly toxic, especially when you scale it up to Earth magnitude and you operate like that for 12,000 years. What's required instead is playful care. It doesn't mean care that is cynical. We actually have quite a lot of that. Big corporations now enforce fun in the most coercive manner. You're supposed to sing company songs or participate in collective team building activities or use video game like interfaces for something like gamification. And he says we need something like the inverse, something like a playful seriousness. This mode would have a slight smile on its face, knowing that all solutions are flawed in some way. So I like that way of thinking about it. And I like shifting the metaphor from solving a problem to just exploring like a possibility space, because every time you quote unquote solve a problem, you always create a new one. But it's really about the process of like exploring what are the possibilities and continuing to do that in the infinite game way that James Kars talks about.
Right. And the last question I have for you is that, you know, I'm curious where you're headed or what you're planning to do with this sort of, I don't know if I want to call it career, but you know, sort of what you're intellectually interested in, your intellectual adventures and speculations. Where is it taking you?
Yeah. So, I mean, for my career so far, I've been a designer. I designed first like on the Hillary Clinton campaign, and then I was designing at Uber. But I felt like up to this point, I've always been sort of like pre-gaming for the pre-game. And this gap has been the first time where I've really got to just explore my own curiosities and readings and writings and just kind of see where that leads really on a day-to-day basis. So I haven't really looked further out than like 2 or 3 weeks. And I'm still kind of sticking to that for now. But next week I'm going to this free speech salon in San Francisco, which is going to be a bunch of people talking about various issues related to the future of free speech and how it will work in light of like all the new media and technology we've created, very similar to the topics we've talked about. So a lot of what I'm trying to do is just put thoughts out there, put writing out there, talk to people like you, go to things like the free speech conference, and sort of just follow my nose and see where it ends up leading when I'm open to possibilities.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's like a lot of my online adventures has been just basically Damon inspired, right? It's like, yeah, writing whatever I write or who I interview on this podcast is just like something calls me towards it that I want to explore further. And right. Even that's how I decide to read books. I'm not like systematic about it.
Right. And I mean, it's really wild. Like I've only been doing it for 4 months, but the number of just doors that I've opened and
man,
interesting relationships I've been able to form has been awesome.
And that's what I wanted to mention on the go local piece, you know, like my desire to go local. But if I just stuck with the localness, then man, my network has been increased like tenfold, like you, ever since I released that white paper, started the podcast. It's just you meeting all these really cool, interesting people that I wouldn't have met otherwise.
Right.
Through my meetup groups or my social network.
Yeah. And when you're open on Twitter, especially, I love this metaphor that Twitter is like tapping a tuning fork and seeing who resonates.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it really is a way to find people who are on your wavelength, trying to think through similar problems, a sort of digital localism that can then turn into real life relationships too, which is really special and very, very rare in the, you know, in the broad scheme of human history. Like you said, I think you tweeted the other day, like find the others, right? It's never been easier to do that.
Right. Yeah. That's a good note to leave on. So Aaron, any place where people can find you, what you're doing next?
You can just find me on Twitter. That's probably the best place. I'm at Aaron Z. Lewis.
Very cool. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, man. That was really fun.
Thanks, Peter.
All right, everyone. Till next time, keep exploring.